It's time for Your Home with Mike and Jill, a talk show about everything Long Island. And here are Mike McLean and Jill Conway McDowell.
Well, happy Sunday, everybody.
And good morning, guys. Thanks so much for joining us on this Sunday morning. I'm Mike McLean alongside Jill Conway McDowell, and we're so glad that you guys are back with us for another Sunday morning show. Don't forget, if you have questions, you can always email us at signature@yourhome@signaturepremier.com.
I can't remember that. Every week you say it.
And yet. I do. I'm staring right at you.
I know. You can also go to our Facebook page, to Your Home with Mike and Jill. So we have a fabulous guest today.
Long Island knows him, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And New York knows him.
Yeah, he's known around the country, actually, and he's a wonderful person who has worked passionately to represent many Long Islanders.
And really make a difference. Yeah. And we are glad and so welcome to have with us today Peter King.
Hi, Pete.
Hey, great to be with you. Thank you very much. Really, really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you. Absolutely. And Jill, it's great to talk to you. Oh. All these years, you've been a real star, so now now that I'm going to be in the radio business, I can say I'm a friend of Jill Conway.
Oh, that's so nice, Pete. Thank you very much. Well, you could have said it before, you know. But now that we're both radio stars, you know how it is. We're in the biz. Well, talk to us about that. Let's start off. What are you retired, and you let everyone know you were retiring a year or so ago or more. And now let's talk about, you have new endeavors on the horizon. What's going on?
Yeah, I announced in November of 2019 that I wasn't going to run again. It had been 28 years in Congress. I loved every minute of it. Right now, I'm getting up in age a bit, but my wife Rosemary and I are in good health. We just wanted to be able to spend some time. My daughter's moved to North Carolina. I want to be able to visit her and my grandchildren. I'm staying on Long Island. I'm not moving. I just wanted more time to get around. And after 28 years, again, I enjoyed every minute of it, but I thought it was time to turn a new page, begin a new chapter. What have I been doing? Basically, I am living here in Seaford, enjoying myself. I've set up a consulting business, so I am going to be a consultant to Northwell, and that I find very challenging. But also, I have been offered a radio show to co-host on WABC. It'll be every afternoon, and it's something I'm looking forward to. I've done a lot of media over the years. It's going to be interesting being on the other side of the microphone now. But I look forward to basically being able to discuss issues. Listen, I have some pretty strong views, right of center, in most cases. Not always, but most of the time. But I think what has changed in politics dramatically, and it was never that great in the old days, but it's getting worse, I think. And that's the animosity people have, refusing to accept the other person's opinion. So I like to be able to discuss these issues in a rational way. And also maybe show a bit of levity or a bit of human understanding. And we'll have guests on the show who are going to, some will agree, some will disagree, but hopefully do it in an intelligent way rather than so much of the screaming and yelling that we see so often.
I'm glad you mentioned that. It's very sad to see that, because people just don't respect someone else's opinion. And we all have difference of opinions. And we mentioned that on a previous show, Mike, where, just you don't have to agree with someone, but you don't have to attack them over it.
Well, you hear these stories about how families being divided at Thanksgiving dinner and, lifetime friends not talking to one another. Again, it's, we've had a rough year with the pandemic and so, some of the other type things going on, obviously, the rising crime, demonstrations getting out of control on all sides. But the fact is, we still are the most prosperous country in the world, the freest country in the world, and people are able to do things today they were never able to do before. We take it for granted. I think we should step back and realize, hey, we have real things to discuss and even argue about, but not to get so despondent, not to get so angry, and not to think that the world was at an end. So, in any event, that's part of where I'm coming from. Again, I can fight as hard as anyone for what I believe in, but I don't always think the person on the other side is evil or venomous or is out to destroy the country.
Where it's just an open conversation where two people can sit, engage, listen to each other, and walk away saying, hey, maybe I learned something just by listening to you. I think that's a bit of something that is lacking in today, and even more so today because of how angry and frustrated people are over politics, over arguments and whatnot. But Peter, I got to ask you a question. Back in 1977, yeah, that's when it seemed to have all started for you, right? Hempstead Council, right? What made you actually say to yourself, this is what I want to do? Where did that passion come from?
Yeah, Yeah, I guess I've always been somewhat competitive in that I enjoy being in the arena. I tried it at baseball. I was okay, but not that good. I was on a JV basketball team in high school as far as I got. But I was always engaged somewhat as far as the competition, the public arena. And I really had a fascination with politics going back to when I was a kid, watching national conventions on television. And plus the idea of being able to get out there and fight hard for what you believe in. And in my case, it would be basically to protect middle-income families, whether it's in New York City where I grew up or out here on Long Island, where, again, you have people who are not in the headlines, they're not involved in dramatic work, they're not involved in any tremendous causes. They're trying to raise their families in a safe neighborhood, send their kids to good schools, and you'll be able to afford a decent standard of living. And so I became engaged locally in the local Republican Club in the early 70s. I had my own law firm, but then I went in the Nassau County Attorney's Office, and then I became a general counsel for the Off-Track Betting Corporation when that was starting. And, one thing led to another. There were openings. And because I've been a campaign manager for Congressman Norman Lent, my name had gotten out there. People have seen me. And when there's an opening for town board for councilmen, they even though we were all elected at large in those days, townwide, the opening really came on the east end of the town of Hempstead. Seaford is certainly, in fact, it's the furthest east section of the town of Hempstead. And Al D'Amato, give him credit, he was running for presiding supervisor. He strongly supported me. And, I was offered the nomination, and I jumped at it. And then, again, that was really a terrific opportunity, being able to work in the community, getting out there. And then I, 4 years later, in 1981, there was an opening for Nassau County Comptroller. And again, the Republicans offered me that nomination. I took it, ran countywide. Now, I don't want anyone to get the idea that all my campaigns have been successful. I also ran for New York State Attorney General in 1986, and I managed to get 1.3 million votes.
Wow.
The only problem is my opponent got 2.5 million votes. Mm. So I lost by 1.2 million. Not that I remember the numbers.
but that's pretty amazing. Experience. That's pretty amazing to get that many people to vote for you, too.
Well, so it was a great experience of going around the state and also playing at a higher level, having debates around the state, holding news conferences in Buffalo and Rochester and also New York City and Nassau and Suffolk. It was a way to break away from the field a bit. So I lost the election, but I was still county controller. And then in 1992, the congressional race opened up. And I think one of the reasons I was able to get the nomination for that was that I had had the experience of running statewide. And also the predecessor who was stepping down in 1992 was Norman Lent. And I had been his campaign manager back in 1972. And we had remained close friends ever since. So he was a great help to me. I've had a lot of good friends help me along the way. And I make no apologies for that. And I don't try to claim all the credit. There are people there to help me. And also, I'm maybe old-fashioned this way. I like the idea of having strong political organizations. I know that politics is sort of looked down on now, and we say everything should be totally wide open and independent. There's a real advantage, I think, to having local political organizations. They give people who aren't millionaires the opportunity to get ahead, to get supporters. I mean, when I run for Congress, I had to get, I think it was 1,250 signatures on petitions every year. That was a state requirement. I never did anything. It was all done by the local Republicans would put in 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 signatures for me just as local committeemen going around doing the job. Upstate, you talk to people. They have to go out and pay people to go out and get signatures for them. So it's important to have an organization behind you, and the organization is responsive to the local constituents and local neighborhoods. They sometimes, obviously, there's there can be abuses and things can go wrong. But on balance, I found since I went to Congress that because I've been part of a political organization, that means dealing with your neighbors, dealing with friends, dealing with communities, dealing with people that disagree with you, you're better able to size up an issue, size up what's real and what's not. And as opposed to some guy, a woman who's just going to a midlife crisis and decides to spend $5 million and run for Congress. And then when they get there, they really have never been involved in the whole political process or the governmental process. And so anyway, that's really where I got where I was. And for better or worse, I tried to do the best I could.
No, I think you absolutely did for so many of us, you know, here. But I wanted to ask, is there a special moment in all of your years that you remember the most that just really, you know, fills your heart?
Stood out to you, I think. One of those defining moments, I guess, in your congressional career of almost 30 years.
Yeah, it's more remarkable.
Yeah, I would say the main one, which was both tragic but in some ways very moving and very uplifting, was 9/11. Mm. I mean, that just came out of nowhere. And the districts here in Long Island were hit as hard as anywhere. I mean, between the two districts I've had, you know, they get changed every 10 years. I had probably over 250 people killed on murdered on 9/11. And the tragedy of that, of actually trying to get your head together as to what that really encompassed, what it was about, and actually being down at Ground Zero with President Bush when he went down there, and knowing the people like the old fireman, Bob Beckwith, that President Bush had his arm around. He became a good friend of mine. So knowing all these people, and also knowing so many friends and neighbors who lost family members, that was the really tragic. Like, there's no tragedy that, to me in my lifetime has compared to that. On the other hand, the positive coming from that was the spirit of the people of Long Island, the people of New York, the people of America, and working with those families. We had a tough fight because even though there was national unity at the beginning, as time went by, it sort of went into people's rearview mirror who were not from the New York, Long Island area or northern New Jersey. So we had to fight very hard to get compensation for the families of those who were killed that day. I mean, you could have somebody who was 29, 30 years old, had an outstanding career ahead of them on Wall Street, and suddenly, you know, they're gone. And the idea was to show what their future income would have been, compensate the families for that. And then something which really none of us saw at the time as being so dangerous was the 9/11 health issues. And many of those illnesses that came from 9/11 was very slow-growing cancers or latent dormant cancers, blood diseases, and which have – so more people have died, I believe, from injuries – from illnesses from 9/11 that actually died that day. And there's going to be many more, unfortunately, going to be ill through that. So we had a fight. It took us almost – wow. It wasn't until the end of 2010 that we finally got the 9/11 Victims Compensation Bill passed, and that would be for people or their families who were ill because of 9/11 illnesses. And that only lasted till 2015. We had to get it renewed again in 2015. And then there's another compensation bill that was running out of money. We had to get that extended in 2019. This has really been an 18-year fight, working with the families, working with the police and fire departments, construction unions, all of the first responders, even people living in those communities near 9/11, to make sure that we got them the health care that they deserve, and also to make sure the families get compensated, or they get compensated if they were injured and didn't die but have been unable to work because of the either injuries or illnesses sustained. So I would say 9/11 and all that encompass was certainly the most vivid in my mind and memory and emotions.
And you really were front and center in fighting for everyone, for so many Long Islanders and New Yorkers. And why do you think it really was such a problem getting that message out and getting compensation? I mean, you would think everyone would be on the same page.
Yeah, Especially during that time. That was a
troubling time. And it still was to some extent. When you got to Congress, I didn't realize the extent of animosity or resentment there is toward New York from other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And some of it's political, some of it's just almost tribal in that they look upon us as different species of people up here in New York. You know, the image we have of being fast-talking and wise guys and arrogant, all that. And
that is true in other parts of the country. They do view that as New Yorkers. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they looked upon, I mean, it was really frustrating. For instance, with the victims compensation, or the health benefits, the one that passed in 2010, there was a feeling that this was just a scheme that was being put together by slick New York City lawyers and phony union members trying to get extra benefits. I mean, to hear this talk about people who were either killed or maimed or suffering debilitating illnesses, you know, from 9/11. I remember on the when we had the 9/11 health bill, we named it after James Hidroga, who, as far as we could tell, was the first person who died from 9/11 illnesses. And he was a NYPD officer. And on the day of the final debate, when we finally got the debate on the House floor, and we were going to vote on it, I remember one of the people who was arguing against it, he was basically saying that Hidroga wasn't really there, that he was a phony, this is all late. And James Hidroga's father was sitting in the House gallery listening to all this. So it was, again, it's hard to explain unless you're there, but this just distrust of New York was a large part of it. And but in any event, we finally did get it through. But that was disturbing. And if I could just go to another topic in that same way, Hurricane Sandy was. I mean, I remember when Katrina hit in 2005. We voted Congress voted within 10 days to send $65 billion to those states, mainly Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and because we knew that that was absolutely essential. People were dying, and they were. You had to bring those cities and regions back. When Sandy came, which actually there was more damage.
And you played a big impact on that as well.
The most they offered us was $27 billion. And yet, and we had to wait 4 months. We had to fight for everything. We ended up getting $61 billion, and I had to really go to the House floor, challenge my party leadership. That was another tough one. It really was. It was... again, the New York animosity, they're talking about how all this money is going to be wasted, how the damage really isn't that great. And again, I would go out, you know, just going through my district, going to places like, at that time, Long Beach was in my district, Lindenhurst, South Massapequa. These look like third world countries. They were literally underwater. Mm. Houses were wrecked. People had their lifetime, you know, their life's belongings out on the front lawn. It was... And yet Congress was saying that this was not that bad. And again, I just thought of all those states and the members of Congress from states like Alabama and Louisiana and Mississippi who voted against us. And yet we had given them so much money, so much relief, and we did without hesitation. So that created some lasting resentment for me to them. So, but again, you know, life goes on. That's what it's all about. In the end, we did get the funding, but it was a tough fight. Something that we really shouldn't have had to go through.
You say that, you know, obviously from all that you're talking about, you really are a fighter. You know, it's no joke that you graduated from Notre Dame, the, you know, Fighting Irish, and that isn't something right. that you embody. But, I mean, did you go in there with a certain set of goals, and do you feel that you accomplished that?
Yeah, I think overall I was able to accomplish. The main group of people, if you want to middle-income, hardworking people. They are the backbone of the communities here on the South Shore. And I wanted to make sure that they weren't passed over when legislation was being passed, whether it's tax increases, tax reductions, a different type of governmental projects that had to be done. I wanted to make sure that they were protected. Also, I wanted to make sure that the police and fire departments received the funding that they need, especially after 9/11. New York City, Nassau, and Suffolk are still the number one terrorist target in the world. And we can't let our guard down. I know we have so many other issues that are going on right now, including the pandemic. But the fact is, there's terrorists out there who are waiting to strike us at the first opportunity. We have to keep that in mind. It's Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all of those groups are still there. Mm-hmm. And they're still constantly probing. Now, we have defenses we put in place after 9/11. We have to continue to fund them. We have to sustain them. We have to make sure that they get all of the equipment that they need. So that's something, again, that I've been really had to work on. I think building up the defenses after 9/11 to protect us, I thought was, again, part of, first of all, it's important for the country. It's important for everyone's life. But also, again, you know, these are people in my district, the middle-income people, who would be victims again. And I wanted to make sure that that never happened. Also, in foreign policy, I wanted to make sure that the United States always had the strongest possible military and that we would stay as united as we can when we did get involved, if we had to get involved in foreign wars or military operations. So again, I would say supporting the military, supporting the police, supporting middle-income voters, and also realizing that, and certainly in the district I've had for the last 10 years, We also have large numbers of minority voters who, again, you know, the economic levels are lower, the housing conditions, all of that. And that requires also to be specifically addressed, including, and we've seen this during the pandemic, that people in minority communities, the low-income communities, become ill quicker than others. They get less medical attention than others. So I've really become an advocate also for community health centers, in especially in immigrant neighborhoods. I mean, my grandparents were Irish Americans. My parents might as well have been, you know, the way they were raised. They were very much old school, and they hardly ever went to doctors. I mean, it sounds crazy today, but there's a certain reluctance that people have about going to for medical care, going to hospitals. And that's why I believe that in communities which have large numbers of immigrants, it's really important to have community health centers, places where they would feel comfortable, where they don't have to go through all the red tape. It's not like having to go to a major hospital or even an emergency room. To have these community health centers where testing is available, health care is available. And that's also been a goal of mine over the last 10 years in those lower income minority immigrant communities.
You know what I'm enjoying listening to you, and I'm listening to your extreme passion. Mm. You know, it's just very much alive in you, and I absolutely love that. And I absolutely love that you are a true Long Islander. You're still here. You're still living here in Seaford. And I wanted to ask, let's have a little fun for a moment, Peter, right? Give me, it might sound silly, but, you know, people want to know, right? What's your favorite restaurant on Long Island? Ooh. Do you have one?
Probably Giulio Cesare. That's a great place. Giulio Cesare. I believe it at that. There's a lot I go to. I've been leaving so many out, but I would say that's probably the main one.
All right, so let's do this. We're in snow season. Is that the favorite season, or which of Long Island's seasons are your favorite?
I would say spring. It's a combination of the ending of the winter, the coming of the baseball season. And not that I'm that poetic or anything, but there's a certain smell in the air, an aroma that you get from the leaves, the trees, the grass,
fresh.
and that new gush of warm air. So I would say the spring.
That is very poetic there, Pete.
It is. Yeah. It's fresh. I like it. It's like it's almost like a new beginning, you know? Yeah.
So what advice, what do you think now, what advice would you give to anyone thinking of going into politics?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, unless you're a multimillionaire and you think you can just buy yourself a nomination somewhere, if you want to do it and really do it the best way, it's to get involved in your community, in an issue in the community, whether it's the local schools, whether it's some environmental issue, whether it's support for the police, an issue in your community you think it's important, get involved in that. But also get involved in a local political club, because really to get things done, politics is you know, that's how it is done. And, you know, we look down on politics here in this country. When I've traveled all over the world as a member of Congress to these third world countries or countries behind the Iron Curtain who emerged, and voting and election and politics, it's like a lifeblood to them. To them, it's like a gift from heaven to be able to actually vote for people of your own choice. So put away this thing of politics being a dirty business. Get involved in your local political club, Republican club, Democratic club, whatever. And then as you're building up a name recognition in the community on particular issues, as you get involved in campaigns, going around door to door, going to train stations, supporting individual candidates, your name will get done. And if you're lucky and if you play your options right, something will open up for you. I can tell you that. Political leaders are constantly looking for people who they think have the ability to project themselves, to protect their view, project their views, and also to articulate what their neighbors and constituents are concerned about. So, again, there's no guarantee you're going to get a nomination. There's no guarantee that you're going to be a great political success. A lot of that depends on factors beyond your control. But even if you don't, you're involved in the process. You're in the arena. And as Teddy Roosevelt said, there's really no thrill or no excitement better than being in the arena itself, being out there fighting for what you believe in.
Well, thank you, Pete. I mean, you served your country and all of us so well. And you have earned the right to retire. And although you're not really retired.
Retiring? He's heading over to WABC to co-host the show Monday through Friday.
That's right. That's right. But he'll have more time with his wonderful wife and his children his grandkids and who I have met. I have been to, Pete was always available, always, to people in the media. And he invited you over to his house. If he was there, and I've been to his house, and it's the same house you've lived in for many years, and you are not.
Yeah, I've been here since 1971 in this house.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. And you haven't shied away from just being, the man of the people and being out there on every issue you have fought for people.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Jill.
Yeah, thank you, Pete.
And by the way, did you see all the silverware when you came to my house?
I did. And the remote. wonderful. And we really want to thank you for being on our show. We appreciate it.
No, it was my pleasure. Thank you, and hope everyone has a great Sunday.
Yeah, and you know what? Please come back if you're allowed. I mean, the other stations.
Competing stations.
You know. I got you.
But we'd love to have you back. So,
Pete, great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Enjoy your Sunday, Pete.
You too. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Bye now.
What an amazing interview. And again, like I said, you know, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. I mean, we're all Americans, and we all believe, you know, we all believe that our opinions are important, no matter what they are, right?
100%.
So, and we can all just agree to disagree. But what I find amazing about someone like, you know, Pete King or, you know, even Charles Schumer or Kirsten Gillibrand is that they go beyond. They talk the talk and walk the walk, and they serve, and they don't hide behind the keyboard, and you know they and say their views on social media, but they truly fight for the people in their community, and I think it's an amazing thing, and I think it's something to be really respected. And admired, right?
Yeah,
because
100%.
Not everybody does that.
No, they don't.
Or they're not willing to do it because right now it's really dangerous, you know, to speak your mind and fight for something.
And it shouldn't be like that. It should just be more of like, hey, take the time to listen. And it's so important to do that. We can learn from each other by doing that. I learned in the last 28 minutes or so, boy, this guy has such passion for what he's doing, and he really was doing it to make a difference. And for that, I applaud him on all fronts. And thank you guys so much for joining us once again on this Sunday morning. We're so glad that you took the time to spend a little time with us, and we hope that you guys have an amazing week ahead.
Yeah, and you know what? We wanted to bring different Long Islanders to you who call Long Island home, who are passionate about living here, because we're passionate about living here. Our goal, well, it's not really Sunday, our goal is to move you, I mean, literally, because we're real estate agents, but also, you know, emotionally and, you know, maybe spiritually along the way, and give you something to think about for the week.
And don't forget, if you have any questions, feedback, or any sort of questions that you have for us, email us at yourhome@signaturepremier.com.
And be sure to check out our Facebook page. You can contact us there as well and see our faces. You're Home with Mike and Jill. We're on Facebook too. So be kind.
Create a great week.
All right. Take care, everybody.